Are you ready for the conscience of psychiatry? For the best-selling author of Talking Back to Prozac, Medication Madness, and now Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, it's the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour with guests unafraid to speak the truth about psychiatry and psychology and about how you can make the most of your own life.
And this is Dr. Peter Bregan. Glad once again to be on PRN for my hour talk show. Catching up on a couple of items that many of us have been following, we have yet another inexplicable murder that may very well be drug-related. Chris Kyle, who's a decorated soldier, a sniper, supposedly the best there ever has been, was helping other soldiers who have PTSD, volunteering to help them deal with their issues. And he was at a shooting range with a friend and a young soldier that he was trying to help, a man named Eddie Ray Ruth, who shot and killed him. Now, Ruth's, from what we can tell, had PTSD, was diagnosed with PTSD, which I define as the reaction of a normal person with a normal brain to horrendous stress, a kind of inevitable response to warfare. And from my experience, speaking at and interviewing people at military conferences, military stress conferences, just about every single soldier who gets any kind of diagnosis, psychiatric, is put on three or more drugs. In my experience, where I've been involved in legal cases against the VA, soldiers with PTSD are just routinely put on one drug after another until they're on 6, 7, 8 drugs. And I think we need to once again call for open disclosure in cases of violence of what psychiatric drugs is the individual on. We still don't know about the Connecticut shooter. I spoke recently to a public official who should have this information, is the kind of person that you would expect to be able to obtain this kind of information. And much to his frustration, he had not been able to obtain any information on whether the Connecticut shooter was on psychiatric drugs, even though there are hints in the press from friends and so on that he at least at one time was on psychiatric drugs. Now, another interesting thing that's going on is an increasing call for things like a mental health registry, mental illness registry, to identify people who could be violent. President Obama has encouraged and may be on the verge of ordering physicians and other healthcare providers, not just psychiatrists, to report people who are violent to the feds, potentially violent. Of course, just a judgment made by an individual who may have no ability to make the judgment at all. Indeed, there's no evidence that any individual professional can make a judgment that somebody is actually going to become violent. Now, the premise of all of that, which is, by the way, coming from both the left and the right in the United States, both the left and the right are calling for more psychiatric power, more psychiatric control over individuals. The premise is that psychiatry is, A, good for people, and B, will be able to detect violence. Well, if we look at our latest shooter, killed two men, including Christy Kyle, this Mr. Eddie Ray Ruth, he was hospitalized twice in the past year, including once in January and once in last September. That didn't stop him. Almost every single one, has passed through psychiatry in the U.S., apparently to no avail, and probably making the individual worse by increasing the sense of humiliation and being coerced, and hence the sense of revenge. And nearly all of them were probably on psychiatric drugs, if only we had the data, at the time of the shooting, because of their recent exposures to psychiatry. Briefly, I was, as some of you by now know, an expert in cases surrounding Columbine and can say with certainty that Eric Harris was on Luvox, which is fluvoxamine, an SSRI antidepressant, put on it a year earlier, at which time we have no evidence that he was a disturbed person, but rather an obsessive youngster. And gradually he became crazier and more violent over the year and had a blood level of this drug in his body on autopsy. If you go to my website, look up mass murder in the various indices on the front page, you'll get to four or five late recent features I've done, one of which is about Sanjay Gupta and others in a moment of passion after the shootings, saying that psychiatric drugs can contribute to violence. Tom Ridge was the other one who was in a great position to know these things. He was the original, head of, secretary of Homeland Security, and he was on the commission from Virginia Tech, saying the same thing, that even saying that Eric Harris may have been under the influence of psychiatric drugs, which may have contributed to his violence. So we need openness, and there are some legislators around the country calling for more openness about violent people who, people have committed horrendous violence, more public knowledge being brought forth about whether they were on psychiatric drugs or not. So if you're in any position anywhere to let people in power know that this is something very important, please do it. My guest today, somebody I'm really looking forward to getting to know, because other than one really nice phone call, we have not been in personal touch with each other. His name is Robert K. Ferry. Ferry is spelled F-E-R-R-I-E. Robert, are you there?
Yes, I am. Hi, Peter.
All right. Hi. Should I call you Bob?
You can call me Bob, sure.
Yeah, and I'm Peter, as you said.
Okay. Well, it's okay to call you Peter.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, okay.
Bob is a graduate of the University of Toronto. He's a Canadian. He was actually practicing in the field of urology. Eventually became interested in psychotherapy through the exposure to Jung and got some training. He also has been trained in eye movement desensitization reprocessing, EMDR, which is a method for getting at traumatic experiences. His practice centers on the victims of childhood, what he calls adverse experiences, trauma, and also adult psychological trauma. He's been aware since the 1980s of the dangers of psychiatric drugs, which is how, of course, we got in touch with each other. He's apparently really looking carefully at his cases over the years, and he's concluded that the psychiatric drugs don't help, but in fact worsen the patient's condition. In his words, unnecessarily complicate the course of therapy, because, in his words, neurotoxic. He's in practice in Caledon, C-A-L-E-D-O-N, north of Toronto. And just one last word. I started using the term neurotoxic to describe psychiatric drugs decades ago, and I can't tell you the grief I got for that in the beginning. But now, heck, even establishment people sometimes talk of neurotoxicity. Welcome to the show, Robert K. Ferry, M.D.
Thank you. I'm honored to be here.
I'm really glad to get to know you, to know another Canadian. who is, skeptical of drugs and doing other things. Just talk for a little bit about yourself and about any aspect of your work you'd like to folks to know about.
Sure. I started doing psychotherapy back in the early 80s, I guess around 84, and one of my first patients was a 18-year-old girl whose mother and father had both committed not suicide, but they both died of cancer. And she went to her doctor. She was feeling very sad, as one might expect, and she was placed on Prozac, this new magic drug, which was supposed to improve her depression, as it was diagnosed. She came to me for psychotherapy, and she was extremely suicidal, and it took about a year of therapy and being on call pretty well 24/7 with her, because every night she would phone me up to let me know that she was still alive. Finally, after about a year, she made the connection with the drugs. I didn't make that connection because I thought, this is an antidepressant. It must be helping her. I can't take her off it. I didn't even suggest it. But she herself decided to go off these drugs, and she did. And lo and behold, all the suicidal thought went away. And she never had another thought of that sort, and she went on to have a very successful life. So I thought, these drugs maybe aren't all they're cracked up to be. And I wasn't very keen on seeing drug reps. I never had seen them when I was practicing in urology. So I didn't get exposed to all the hype. I didn't get exposed to all the articles, although I did read the medical literature a great deal. And I found my patients did very well on psychotherapy, and then when I got into EMDR, they did even better when I focused more on trauma. So I was going along fine, and then over the years, I find more and more people are on these drugs when they come to me. And that's where I'm at the moment, dealing with those people, as well as the ones that come in that are sort of clean and not on drugs. And I notice there's quite a difference between the two groups. So that's where I'm coming from.
Well, a lot of people in Canada are going to be glad to hear you're there. I don't know if...
I'm not taking new patients right now, by the way. I'm
okay.
Completely booked up.
So you're not rushing to join our resources center on empathictherapy.org. I hope
no.
You will at some point.
Okay.
And... Now, you have some colleagues who are doing similar work, right?
Yes. Well, I practice EMDR, so I belong to a group of EMDR therapists, and we meet once a month and have discussions. But they are social workers and psychologists, and they also are seeing a lot of their clients on these drugs, but they're kind of afraid to say anything about it. So I'm making a presentation at the EMDR Canada conference in May on psychiatric drugs and EMDR and how the two how to deal with people that are on these drugs.
I'm really, really, really glad to hear that. Have you written anything about the drugs?
I haven't actually written any articles. I've done some studies. I've made a number of presentations. What I did was, in preparation for this thing I'm doing in May, I went through 55 randomly selected patients that were not current patients, and all of them had a post-traumatic checklist in the PTSD range, like above 44, PCLC it's called, post-traumatic checklist for civilians, and they were all in the PTSD range above 44. Both the ones that were on drugs and the ones that were off drugs. And I had 24 that were off drugs when they first came into therapy, 27 that were on, and at the end of their therapy, which many of them got better, some of them just got to the end of therapy and decided to quit. And what I found was that the ones that had been off drugs when they came into therapy, about three-quarters of them, actually 79%, were in a normal range on their post-traumatic checklist at the end of therapy, compared to 50%, half of those that were on drugs when they started. But then there was a group who couldn't get off drugs because of the addictive qualities, I guess, and were on too many, maybe three drugs at a time, and they just couldn't get off them. And there were nine of those, and only one of them got his checklist down to a normal range with EMDR. So those people had the hardest time, the ones that couldn't get off, as one might expect. So it's kind of, you can get them off, I find, most of them, but they still take longer. I think if I worked on them longer, they might have done, I might have got the rest of them down. But basically, the ones that weren't on drugs to begin with did better. That's my conclusion.
Well, it makes a lot of sense. One of the things that we seldom think about is that the adverse effects of many psychiatric drugs are indistinguishable from the effects of PTSD.
Uh-huh.
And the effects of PTSD are also sometimes hard to distinguish from post-head injury.
That's true.
And so we end up with somebody on antidepressants, and they are going to get more anxious, more jumpy, more hyperreactive, more agitated, have more insomnia, very possibly, especially early on in the treatment, and they're just going to look, quote, sicker to the prescriber, as, you know, that PTSD is getting worse.
Yeah.
They're likely to get even more of the drug then.
Yeah.
Stimulants have very similar effects to the list I just gave. And then even the benzos increase violent tendencies, can increase irritability. And if you take them more than a week or two, they can increase insomnia.
Uh-huh.
So we're giving people all these drugs, and then they're getting Abilify and Seroquel and drugs that can cause akathisia, this terrible restlessness.
Mm-hmm.
So the drugs mimic PTSD and just so complicate the issues.
Yeah, you know, one thing I found, I've had a number of people just recently, I've started asking them, you know, do you ever have any violent thoughts? And one young lady in her 30s who'd been on Paxil, she said, you know, I'm interested that you asked me that. I wouldn't want to tell anybody this because they might think I was violent and crazy. But when I was on Paxil, I had this recurrent vision in my head of smashing my girlfriend's face in. And I could see the blood running down. It was really bizarre. And it went on day after day after day, she said, until finally I just said, she was smart enough to say, this must be the drug. So she stopped the Paxil, and the visions all went away. That was one. Another one was a guy in his 50s, early 50s, who was taking an SSRI, and he had the vision of wanting to stab his wife. He'd never told anybody this. He didn't tell his psychiatrist, didn't tell his doctor, his prescribing doctor. He fortunately trusted me enough to tell me, and he's slowly coming off the drugs, and he's getting better. But I wonder if we don't know how common these violent visions are in people on these drugs because nobody ever asks them, and they certainly don't want to tell anybody. But if somebody actually made a study, we might be surprised at what we came up with, how many people actually have these violent thoughts.
Yeah, there's a study that doesn't answer that question but does confirm the violence. People can Google it. If you Google Thomas Moore,
uh-huh.
Thomas Moore, violence FDA, there's a study that looked at all the violence reports, and not anger, not just anger or aggression or something, but really violence reports to the FDA for all drugs that are prescription, all
uh-huh.
prescription drugs. They found that over 80% of the drugs had either none or one or two reports,
uh-huh.
but that some drugs had highly disproportionate numbers or increases multiple times And the worst offender was Chantix, which I think has a lot of similar effects to antidepressants.
Huh.
And then the group of antidepressants with Paxil in the lead and Zoloft right up there, but these newer antidepressants, then the benzos, and then the stimulants. And all these groups of drugs had excessive reports by multiple times compared to the vast majority, which had very, very little of these reports.
I worked with a young veteran from Afghanistan, and he was terribly depressed and sad from watching some violent scenes where his friends had been blown up. And he did quite well on EMDR and came off his medication and did even better. And he didn't have violent thoughts, although being a soldier, they're trained to be violent. But when he was on the medication, he found that he started to have violent thoughts. So getting him off again, violent thoughts went away.
You know, and we're putting so many of our troops now on these drugs. We'll send young men and women into combat with 180 days supply of stimulants or benzos or antipsychotic drugs. It's just astonishing.
Good heavens.
And I've heard estimates above 30% for some of the theaters of war. We've never had anything like that before. We never used to put anybody who was on active duty on drugs. I've heard of soldiers who have been told they can't go on active duty without taking psychiatric drugs. It's really quite a bizarre situation.
And yet we have these black box warnings saying that they might cause suicide and violence and to watch carefully for it on the drugs themselves.
Well, that's right. And the suicide one in exactly that age group.
Exactly.
24 and younger, although, frankly, there's a suicide risk at all ages. But there it is in the black box. It's quite a bizarre world we're in now.
Huh.
It's wonderful to hear, you know, that that you're finding your therapy so successful. Now, is most of it EMDR, or are you still doing psychotherapy and more traditionally, or Jungian therapy?
Well, EMDR I use with trauma, of course. I could give you a good example, if you're interested, of actually a patient I saw this morning. She had a near-drowning experience. But I also do, depends on the patient. If they have a trauma in their history, then I use EMDR. But I also use a thing we call ego state therapy from Watkins and Watkins, who developed it, which is often in the beginning of EMDR, you want to stabilize the client. They have to be able to relax when they think of something disturbing, or you can't really get into the processing part of EMDR where you move the eyes. So I find that if it was a childhood trauma, for example, if you can separate the child in your imagination and even imagine the child sitting in the therapy room with you, but separate from you, you can then get into conversations with the child in your mind. And this is very helpful in getting the person to start to deal with the material without getting overwhelmed. Also, things like imaginary walks on the beach with the traumatized child, but just having a good time and not thinking about the trauma, just sort of getting to know that part of your mind. I find that type of thing extremely helpful in the beginning. So that's not really EMDR, but most EMDR therapists do that. I find that helpful. The lady that I saw this morning who gave me permission to discuss her case, it's sort of a classical EMDR case, really. She was swimming in a river with her kids about a year and a half ago, and she had two kids, 7 and 9, two boys, and she wasn't the greatest swimmer. And one of them started to flounder, and she went in to get him, and then the other jumped on her back, and she went under the water, and all of a sudden she felt one of them stop moving, and she thought that child had died. And she thought to herself, and I'm dying too, because she had sucked water into her lungs. She started to go under. And then, as it turned out, both kids were rescued. She was rescued, and she survived. So here she is about a year and a half later. She goes to her family doctor. She's not feeling well. She doesn't know why. She just keeps having, she can't sleep well. She's sort of hyper-excitable. And she doesn't really identify it with the drowning. So he suggests she goes on SSRIs, but she declines that because she had a bad experience before. So we started some eye movements on the drowning, having set up the scene to begin with so that there's, you know, there's the negative thought, I'm going to drown, but then there's the positive thought that actually the reason my son stopped moving was because somebody saved him. He was taken away from me. And they saved the other one, and they saved me. The first time we went through it with eye movements, she didn't improve. Then when we suggested, well, think about as you're going under, they're going to save my son, and the reason he's not moving is because they've actually taken him, and he's safe. The second time we went through it, the SUDs, what we call the subjective unit of disturbance, which is how disturbing is this memory to you when you think of it on a scale of 10, was a 10 to begin with, and by the end of the second session, it was down to zero. She felt completely calm. So, I mean, that's, I won't say that's classical EMDR, but it's what often happens in a single trauma of that sort, and it's a good example of how it's very useful in trauma of that kind. Anyway, it gives you a great mm-hmm. thrill when you can do that for somebody.
Yeah, it's wonderful how much you're helping people. I tend to be skeptical about things like EMDR in terms of the eye movement, and I believe very much that, of course, reliving trauma and handling it in a positive way and the ways you describe is very, very helpful, and you sound like a very caring and empathic therapist, so I'm sure that's very helpful. But I've always been skeptical about, you know, techniques in therapy such as EMDR. Just wanted to let you know that and just give you a chance to also respond.
Excuse me. Sure. I've watched much of your sort of training video on your empathic therapy, and I was quite impressed. And I think you're onto something very important that obviously that approach to patients where you allow them to just talk and you enter into a dialogue with them and you're helpful and you accept whatever they say and take it seriously and don't judge them is the beginning and the essence of all therapy. EMDR, however, I think adds something to that when you're into trauma, cases of trauma. And I agree that much of it is similar to a sort of standard exposure therapy that you find with cognitive behavioral therapy, for example. But actually, the eye movements do seem to make a difference. And there was an article in Scientific American about 3 weeks ago, and they're referring to two articles in the scientific literature where actually the eye movements have been proven to reduce the levels of disturbance more than just an eye-closed part of the study or simply tones in the ears. Eye movements came out ahead. So, I mean, strange as it may seem, they actually do seem to work, and you can prove it. There's been an incredible amount of studies on EMDR, scientific studies, and it's accepted in many jurisdictions. I just find it's a great method of therapy. But I agree, all the other stuff is equal too, and I guess, go ahead.
No, that's fine. We're getting near break. I'm going to take a caller after break. Don't usually do that, but I think this caller sounds like it's relevant enough to do, and we'll be going to break with the music in a minute or two here.
All right.
Really, really, really glad to have you on the show. I'm looking forward to meeting you. I hope you can come to our April conference. And I'm really glad to have you on the advisory council of the Center for the Study of Empathic Therapy.
Well, like I say, I'm very honored. I've read your books for years now, and I never thought I'd actually get to talk to you. But I'm very impressed with what you've done.
Well, thank you much. Thank you much. All right, we'll go to break. And this is Dr. Peter Bregan. And this is the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour. My guest, Robert K. Ferry, spelled F-E-R-R-I.
I-E.
I-E, excuse me, yep. F-E-R-R-I-E, looking out of the corner of my eye as I try to talk into the microphone. How can people get in touch with you?
I guess they could phone me. Probably the best way would be email, robertkferry@gmail.com.
Robert K. Ferry at Gmail.
Yep.
And again, it's Ferry, F-E-R-R-I-E.
That's right.
Let's take a couple of callers, Bob, and I want you to join in. I'll say hello to them, and then I want you to join in as if you were part of the show here, as you are, okay?
Okay.
We have a caller from Toronto, which made me think it's a good idea since you're from Toronto, and I thought his question was one that we might be interested in answering. Is Russell there? Russell from Toronto?
Good afternoon, Dr. Bregan. Thank you for taking my call.
And thank you for your patience. I know we kept you on because I didn't want to interrupt the first half hour. You were asking about liver metabolism of SSRIs?
Yes. Actually, my question is in regard to the cytochrome P450 enzymes and the poor metabolizers, especially for the CYP2D6 enzyme, which metabolizes 20 to 25% of clinical drugs. While the percentage of poor metabolizers varies by ethnicity, 7 to 8% of Western Europeans are poor metabolizers, completely lacking any functional CYP2D6 enzyme.
What percentage did you just say?
7 to 8% of Western Europeans.
Okay. Yes. That's my understanding, too, in that range.
Yes. My question is there an increased risk for the poor metabolizer phenotypes for homicidality and suicidality, whether it's through akathisia, drug-induced psychosis, or frontal gray matter loss with neuroleptics?
Well, there is a physician, Lucier, L-U-C-I-R-E, in Australia, who's actually published some papers where she's found that people who commit acts of violence on SSRIs have a higher rate of poor metabolizing, and it makes sense because it's really just simply getting even more of the medication than intended, and in some cases maybe even more than is recommended. So you'd expect increased toxicity in any area that toxicity got expressed. So I think that's been well established. At least the beginnings of that are established, and it makes sense. I don't have any awareness of other drugs. I haven't seen research on other drugs in terms of producing violence. For example, the akathisia that's caused by the neuroleptics, the antipsychotic drugs, as well as by the SSRIs. I don't know. You seem to know a lot. Russell, have you seen anything about other drugs?
It's personal experience, actually.
With something other than the SSRIs?
Both SSRIs and neuroleptics.
But have you been tested for your enzymes? It's a simple test, not cheap. But
no, I haven't been able to undergo genetic testing yet.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
I have a suspicion, and I was wondering if you could.
I certainly can confirm it about SSRIs. I don't know about the neuroleptics. And, you know, there are a lot of places that test, and you don't need anything but a physician to draw blood and send it in. to get her done, and the prices vary a lot. I don't have that at my fingertips.
Yeah.
Any thoughts from you, Dr. Ferry?
It just seems to me that we're playing Russian roulette. I mean, we have these certain percentage of the population that has that are poor metabolizers, and we know that these drugs cause violence. So it'd be really interesting to find out how many of those shooters were poor metabolizers and how many were on the drugs. I know myself, whenever I hear about one of these awful events, I say, well, was the guy on drugs? You know, why don't they tell me? I want to know, but you never hear it. It's very frustrating. Why are they covering up in such a terrible thing where there's so many lives being lost? I mean, can you imagine if that was an airplane of people going down, we'd have a terrible investigation. You know, we'd find out what was going on. We'd investigate everything. Here, for some reason, it's just carried on business as usual.
So, well, I think the drug companies are responsible for the lack of information coming out. When I wrote Talking Back to Prozac with my wife Ginger in 1994, I had dozens of newspaper reports of people on Prozac in car accidents and committing horrendous crimes. And then as the years went on, the reports got fewer and fewer until now you never see a report about a homicide in the newspaper and the statement that the person was taking a particular psychiatric drug. And I think that has come through pressure from the drug companies who can wield influence in more ways than we literally can imagine. The only reason we got information on Eric Harris was that he was over 20, and the coroner made public, he was 20 years old, he was over 18, uh-huh. Over 18, and the coroner, probably under pressure, released the information, and also I ferreted out the information from looking through FDA reports and finding, you know, a description of somebody who couldn't have been anybody but Eric Harris, and then getting the information from the FDA. So very important, and as I started out the show with, another part of this, Russell, you may have not have thought about, is that the drug companies could easily make these tests available in a routine manner at a relatively low cost. If they pinched to it, they could tell doctors to do these tests. But the drug companies always fight anything that is going to monitor dangers from their drugs.
Huh.
Thank you for calling in,
Russell.
Thank you very much.
We have another
caller whose son has apparently been on SSRIs for a long time. And he's Michael from Cincinnati. And Michael, before you start talking, please take every precaution against identifying in any way who your son might be. So
okay.
Are you there?
Yes,
no,
sir.
Peter, sorry. We really have to make the point that people have to be careful with these drugs and not suddenly come off them. They have
Good.
To come off very slowly under prescriber's supervision, and maybe with the help of their whole family, as you describe in your book, withdrawal. But anyway, that's
throwing that out. Mr. Brigham, and also your guest, Mr. Ferris. I'd just like to make one comment about the last discussion before I tell you what prompted me to call. Sandy Hook's school shooting,
yeah.
Supposedly Adam Lancet was on a drug, Fanax, and just recently, I think within a few days, there's been other communications going out to the public that this uncle who allegedly put it out that he was on that medication has been termed a fraudulent uncle, not even related to Mr. Lancet. And, going back over the last 14 mass killings, according to the information that I've read, most of them, the shooters have been on or coming off of antipsychotic medication. And even in this case of the recent one in Sandy Hook's, they are using the HIPAA law to keep from getting this information out to the general public. The young man, unfortunately, for all of them, are dead. He's dead and gone. And I don't see why a HIPAA law would take precedence over the Second Amendment. You know, but that's, I suppose, to protect the pockets.
Let me interrupt you for a minute. First, it's not antipsychotic drugs that are mostly involved in these
shootings. SSRIs.
It's probably more the SSRIs. Secondly, there's no reason to believe that report. I've talked to people who should know, and there's no reason to believe the report that Adam Alonzo was on anything. The information has simply not come out in any valid way of what he was on. Those are the two things I did want to mention to you. But did you have one other question to briefly ask?
Yes, sir. My son's been on Respitol and Zyprexa for about 10 years, latter 6 years Respitol. And I've been trying to tell his mom that I think he had a misdiagnosis from the beginning. And finally, she's his guardian. They wouldn't let me be his guardian because at the onset, I just didn't want anything to do with antipsychotic medications. And they said that she would be the most appropriate guardian because she was agreeing with the medication.
But
now she's ready to come. She's ready to take him off, and she's using this orthomolecular psychiatry and doing that sort of thing to get him off. And I've gotten your latest book, Withdrawal from Antipsychotic Medication, and gave it to her and got a copy for myself. But I just wanted to know if you knew anything about this orthomolecular psychiatry and how their program is for overseeing or the program for coming off of something like SSRIs.
First, so people can find my book. It's called Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal.
I have it.
No, just so the audience will know what the name was.
Yes, sir.
I have no reason to trust orthomolecular psychiatry. It's been around. People think it's new. I first heard about it, I think, in the 60s. The people who invented it had already discredited themselves. I think anybody who tries to use that to come off of Risperdal or Zyprexa is at hazard. And I would also suggest that these drugs are at least, if not more, difficult to get off of than the older antipsychotic drugs. Yeah. And they cause not only everything the older drugs cause, they cause also obesity and a whole bunch of other problems that can be life-threatening and life-shortening. So, no, I would not particularly at all recommend that.
Okay,
but
Peter,
I want to involve Dr. Ferry and then move on. Bob, I was so glad about what you said last time. What's your response to this?
Well, I've had some experience with orthomolecular psychiatry, which really is largely mega vitamin therapy, some amino acids. It's basically the attempt to nourish the brain, which has been damaged by medication in this case. And I found that it helps my patients. Like, we have a naturopathic college here, which is run by somebody who follows Abraham Hoffer's work, who was the originator, I guess, of orthomolecular psychiatry. And he did double-blind studies on schizophrenics, and he found that using niacin, they were getting good results. And now with essential fatty acids added in and vitamin C, they're getting even better results. So my feeling is the opposite of yours, Peter. I think orthomolecular psychiatry is helpful when you're either on the drugs or trying to come off. I think at both times it's helpful. I'm sorry I disagree, but I do.
Well, first, it wasn't invented to come off the drugs. It was has been pushed since, I think, the 60s as a treatment for schizophrenia. Uh-huh. And, again, I have no reason whatsoever to believe it works for schizophrenics, and so I wouldn't want to particularly rush ahead and try it. I think this stuff is hype, and I think it's false. But we can differ.
Yep.
Happily differ.
They're doing studies now in Israel on it, which will be out shortly.
Well, it's been out there so long. It's been out there a long, long time, and I don't know of any. I'm sure there's always doing studies on that stuff. Well, we can disagree on that. Anything else you wanted to say?
Well, I would just say to Mr. Ferris, thank you for that. And he's going to come off whether he's using Dr. Brigham's method or if I can get her to use his book. But still, the all of the niacin and the vitamin therapy that he's going to be taking here won't hurt anything. I'm sure that's the question I have, will it?
That my opinion is no, it won't hurt anything. But he needs to use Dr. Bregan's methods as well.
Yes, sir.
Coming off.
Okay.
Well, my opinion is I don't know that it won't hurt. I just don't know. Megavitamins are not natural. Once you're giving huge amounts of these drugs, niacin's poisonous to the liver. I don't know what doses are being used in your son's case. So I'd be cautious and maybe Google the doubters as well as the positive people.
I've Googled everything, and I was just fortunate to get into you guys, and I appreciate everything.
Well, your son is fortunate to have you advocating for him. Very, very fortunate.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you very much for calling.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thanks.
Bob, I don't know whether to continue the conversation. I don't think there's much point to continuing the conversation about orthomolecular, but are you using other natural, but well, I don't know. Orthomolecular is not natural. That's ridiculous. Are you using?
I think it is. I agree. It's megavitamins, so you're trying to you're pushing the enzymatic reaction with a megavitamin. That's true. I usually put people on some basic nutrients like essential fatty acids, vitamin C, and minerals if they're on medication and they're trying to come off. I think it makes sense to try and nourish that brain as much as you can. I think the people that practice this are fairly careful. They don't take great risks, you know, in overdoing the dose or anything. And I'm sure they watch the liver. But there's never been any deaths on megavitamins.
How would we ever know that?
Well, there's none reported. Okay.
Yeah.
And they would report
they,
it. I'm sure somebody they, would.
They'd have. I don't know. And psychiatrists, I could assure you they wouldn't report it if they were using it, because I know how they operate. They would never report a death. Almost never. I'm much more skeptical. Much, much more skeptical. I don't know how old you are, but I was there when Eric Hoffer was claiming that he was producing schizophrenia with adrenochrome.
Uh-huh.
Which he thought was a byproduct of adrenaline, but turned out to be just a brown substance that occurred if you exposed current bottles of adrenaline back in those days to sunlight, you know, in a room.
Uh-huh.
So yeah, so I and then the next thing I heard from him was orthomolecular. But listen, what else would you like to focus on about your work? I'm very impressed that you are keeping these case studies and trying to follow them up. And are you planning to actually publish something about it? I know you're going to be giving a lecture about it.
I haven't thought of publishing it, but I'd like to, maybe with my wife who can help me with the writing, because she's a great writer. I noticed in the New York Times in January the 9th, there's a movie coming out called Side Effects, interesting. And one of the things they said on the information about the movie was it's sort of the prequel or the ad about the movie. Important safety information. Adverse reactions associated with this product include dry mouth, nausea, headache, anxiety, insomnia, and murder. So it gives you some idea what this movie is going to be about. It'll be interesting.
Well, I got a call, actually, from folks involved with that movie offering me a tentative invitation to come to New York at one of the pre-opening night events.
Yeah.
To be on a panel of people talking about these issues. I don't think it would be fair to tell you what I know about the movie from those folks, because they also told me about it.
Uh-huh.
But the movie was very disappointing, the description he gave to me of of what the conclusions were.
Oh, dear.
Or what the twists were. And I was not invited. I wasn't invited, although this gentleman was going to get me invited. So I don't know what's going on there.
You didn't see the movie.
No, I'd say watch the movie. It may be hazardous to your health. be careful. That's
yeah.
My morning movie. I heard it was just coming out. It was going to be in January, I think, I was going to go up to New York.
That's right. It's coming out in this month, I think.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah.
Another
yeah.
thing I've been interested in is the case in Winnipeg that you were an expert witness at, where the judge concluded that the boy was under the influence of the medication, which I think was Prozac.
Prozac, yeah.
When he thrust a 9-inch kitchen knife into the chest of his friend.
Yeah.
And I guess you were the expert witness. You must know an awful lot about it. But it seemed to be the first time that the drug was named as that he wasn't free and clear of any of the effects of Prozac when he did this. And now that he was, he had come back to normal, and therefore he got a much reduced sentence.
This is the first time that a judge has said this. Now, see, in Canada, as you know, but most of the Americans aren't going to know, judges play a very, very big role, bigger role in juries in many kinds of cases and situations. We had never had in North America a judge say that that he heard the experts, he heard me, and then he heard, one of, I guess, the most prestigious psychiatrist in that area of the world. And he went through both of our testimony in detail, concluded that I was right. We have had other judges, however, say there was sufficient evidence to go to a jury with this kind of an issue, which is in itself a very powerful and very strong thing to do.
Yeah,
I appreciate you bringing that up. One last question, then I think we're going to be about ending in a minute or two. Maybe I'll get a little message warning me. Can you tell me when did you first hear about me? I love hearing that I'm having an effect because I get so much aggravation as well. When did you first read my work?
Oh, gosh, it must have been 10 years ago. I mean, my wife is a bibliophile, and we get a lot of books. We have a huge library.
Yeah.
And so because I'm in this field, she kept feeding me these books by Bregan. And I would look at him and say, wow, this guy's really got guts.
Yeah.
And that's
Bob,
how I got into it.
I think we're going to the music now. Again, my guest is Robert K. Ferry, F-E-R-R-I-E, a practitioner who does therapy in Toronto. Thanks so much for being on the show.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.